Good evening to you all, and thank you for coming to this Government and Opposition annual lecture named in honour of Leonard Shapiro, former professor of the Government Department here at LSE. I think my job on an occasion like this is to say as little as possible, but just a word about Government and Opposition, a journal which was founded right back in 1965, partly by Leonard, partly by Isabel de Madariaga, and partly by Gita Ionescu. I am here not out of any personal merit, but simply as the convener of the Government Department with which the journal has always been associated, and a journal of which we in the Government Department are very proud. I should say also just a word in honour of Leonard, who was a distinguished professor in our department. He is the professor after whom our student common room is still named. He was also actually my own professor, a man of not just enormous intellectual quality, but also about the most warm and comforting of supervisors and mentors that one could imagine. So I'm doubly delighted to be introducing this lecture as chairman of the department, a lecture named after dear Leonard. But of course, my main job this evening is to introduce our speaker, who is Professor Sheila Ben-Habib from Yale University. She is the Eugene Mayer Professor of Political Science and Philosophy at Yale. To introduce her in any detailed way would take longer than the lecture itself, since she has an immensely distinguished record, which in terms of teaching, I think actually began at Yale, but has progressed among other places through Harvard and is now back, not to where she started, but physically to where she started at a much more distinguished level. She has published an immense number of articles and a great number of books in a number of languages on critical theory, on questions of identity, on questions of postmodernism and of feminism in the context of liberal democracy, on dilemmas of equality and individual rights and multiculturalism in today's world. What she is actually working on right now and what she's going to talk about this evening could not be more topical in contemporary Europe. It is the issue of identity, multiculturalism, the problems of citizenship, and of how you fit migration of people into a world which still defines citizenship in terms of the territorial nation state, and God knows, maybe needs to do so if democracy is to sustain itself, but finds it difficult to do so in a world where people and ideas are moving so rapidly. So thank you very much for coming to talk to us. I think Professor Ben-Habib will speak for about 50 minutes, 55 minutes, and then we'll take questions. Thank you for coming again.
Thank you. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here this evening. And I also thank those of you who may have shown up last November, when this lecture was originally scheduled to occur, for your patience and understanding. In the mid-morning hours of September 11th, shortly after the second twin tower of the World Trade Center had collapsed, and amidst the fog surrounding us all, who, when, why, I heard a brief item of news on the radio. Canada had closed its airspace to all American planes still en route. Since U.S. airports were also closed for several hours on that day, these planes would have no choice but to return to their destination or to circle the airs in search of safe haven, if you will forgive the pun. This news was not repeated. Canada eventually did permit U.S. airplanes to land, and many transatlantic passengers found succor in Iceland's Reykjavik airport for a period of time, up to several days in some cases. This small incident is one among many since September 11, 2001, that have made increasingly transparent the fragility of the territorially bounded state-centric international order. For a few brief hours, the passengers of the airplanes, which could not obtain landing permissions, were like refugees without first admittance claims. The same logic that permits states to deny first admittance to certain refugees and asylees, and often contrary to the Geneva Convention on the Status of Refugees, was operative in this instance as well. Invoking national security concerns, Canada, US's closest neighbor, could, even if briefly, follow the imperatives of sovereign statehood and close its airspace as well as landing privileges to passengers who had now become refugees in orbit in the heavens. We have all read, seen, and heard about countless other dramas. Illegal aliens crossing the channel at Dover in meat trucks and perishing through sub-zero refrigeration. Mexicans misled by the instructions of coyotes who abandon them in the desert stretches along the US-Mexican border and who perish of dehydration. Kurdish asylum seekers swimming to safety from a ship docked outside the waters of Marseille. The peoples of the world are on the move across continents, oceans, and borders. Although in absolute numbers, contemporary migration movements have not reached the level of the latter half of the 19th century, today's migratory movements pose institutionally as well as normatively different kind of challenges than they did in the 19th century. We are in the midst of developments which on the one hand challenge the territorially bound state-centric model which was reestablished in Europe and elsewhere after World War II. On the other hand, claims of sovereign statehood are still the guiding normative and institutional principles in the international arena. There is widespread consensus that the modern nation-state system, characterized by the inner world of territorially bound politics and the outer world of foreign, military, and diplomatic relations. In short, the state-centric system of the 19th and early 20th centuries is, when not at an end, undergoing changes which amount to its deep reconfiguration. James Rossinow captures these changes in brief and dramatic terms. I'm quoting, "The international system is less commanding, but it's still powerful. States are changing, but they are not disappearing. State sovereignty has been eroded, but it's still vigorously asserted. Governments are weaker, but they can still throw their weight around. Borders still keep out intruders, but they are also more porous." End of quote. To ascertain these new trends towards the deterritorialization of politics, need not commit one to exaggerated claims about the end of the nation-state system. In fact, the irony of current political developments is that while state sovereignty in economic, military, and technological domains has been eroded, it is nonetheless vigorously asserted, and national borders, while more porous, are still there to keep out aliens and intruders. The old political structures have waned, but the new forms of political globalization are not in place. The emergence of international human rights norms and the frequent conflict in theory and practice between such norms and national sovereignty claims are the clearest harbingers of new forms of political globalization. The rise of an international human rights regime, precipitated by the 1948 UN Declaration of Human Rights, has proceeded uninterrupted in the last half century. The establishment of the European Union has been accompanied by a European Charter, Convention of Human Rights, and by the formation of a European Court of Human Rights. Following the UN Declaration of Human Rights, many other organizations and charters have placed individual rights at their center as well. To be sure, all these declarations are not agreements which have been signed and ratified. In many cases, they are simply general declarations of intent rather than legally binding documents. The European Convention on Human Rights becomes the law of the land only if it is incorporated into domestic law through the will of national legislatures. In international law, the will of the sovereign can only be bound by voluntarily self-incurred treaty obligations. There is no sovereign to force the sovereign, as Hobbes pointed out many centuries ago. Nevertheless, however abstract and necessarily vague these universal principles of human rights may be, they are slowly being transformed from declarations of intent into generalizable norms capable of enforcement and litigation in the case of specific violations. The transformation of human rights codes into generalizable norms that should ideally govern the behavior of sovereign states is one of the most promising aspects of contemporary political globalization processes. We are witnessing such developments in at least three areas. Humanitarian interventions. The theory and practice of humanitarian interventions, which the USA and its NATO allies appeal to in order to justify their actions in Bosnia and Kosovo, suggests that when a sovereign nation state violates the basic human rights of a segment of its population on account of their religion, race, ethnicity, language, and culture, there is a generalized moral obligation to end genocide and ethnic cleansing. In such cases, human rights norms trump state sovereignty claims. No matter how controversial in interpretation and application, and certainly they are very controversial, they may be, humanitarian interventions are based on the promise that the sovereignty of the state to dispose over the life, liberty, and property of its citizens or residents is not unconditional or limited. The exercise of state sovereignty, even within domestic borders, is subject to certain internationally recognized norms which prohibit genocide, ethnocide, mass expulsion, enslavement, and forced labor. Crimes against humanity. The concept of crimes against humanity, first articulated by the Allied powers in the Nuremberg trials of Nazi war criminals, suggests that there are certain norms in accordance with which state officials, as well as private individuals, are to treat one another, even and precisely under conditions of extreme hostility and war. Genocide, ethnic cleansing, mass executions, rape, cruel and unusual punishment of the enemy, such as dismemberment, are proscribed, and can all constitute sufficient grounds for the indictment and prosecution of individuals who are responsible for these actions, even if they are or were state officials or subordinates who acted under their orders. The refrain of the soldier and the bureaucrat, "I was just doing my duty," is no longer an acceptable ground for abrogating the rights of humanity in the person of the other, even when, and especially when, the other is your enemy. Transnational migrations. The third area in which international human rights norms are creating binding guidelines upon the will of sovereign nation states is that of international migration. Humanitarian interventions deal with the treatment by nation states of citizens or residents within the boundaries of their territories. Crimes against humanity concern relations among enemies or opponents in nationally bounded as well as extraterritorial settings. Transnational migrations, by contrast, concern the rights of individuals, not insofar as they are considered members of concrete bounded communities, but insofar as they are human beings simple, when they come into contact with, seek entry into, or want to become members of territorially bounded communities. As international human rights norms are increasingly invoked in immigration, refugee, and asylum disputes, territorially delimited nations are being challenged not only in their claims to control their borders, but also in their prerogative to define the boundaries of the national community. What should be, then, the guiding normative principles of political membership in a world of increasingly deterritorialized politics? Which practices and principles of civil and political incorporation are most compatible with the philosophical self-understanding and constitutional commitments of liberal democracies? I use the term political membership broadly to refer to the legal, political, economic, cultural, and social practices concerning the admittance, incorporation, and eventual naturalization of immigrants, as well as refugees and asylees. There is a tension, I want to argue, at the heart of the norms and practices engaged in by liberal democracies around the world with regards to political incorporation. This is the tension, and at times outright contradiction, between universal human rights and the sovereign self-determination claims of nations to control their borders, as well as to monitor the quality and quantity of admittees across these borders. There are no easy solutions or answers to the dilemmas posed by these dual commitments. I will not call for the end of the nation state, nor for world citizenship. Rather, following the tradition of Kantian cosmopolitan right, I will underscore the significance of membership within bounded communities and define the need for democratic attachments. Such democratic attachments need not only be directed towards existing state structures, however, subnational as well as supranational spaces for democratic attachments and agency are emerging in the contemporary world, and they need to be furthered along with, rather than in lieu of, existing polities. In the first half of my lecture, I would like to examine political membership claims from the standpoint of normative political theory. In the second half, I will turn to a sociological model of citizenship. At the center of these considerations is the disaggregation of citizenship claims in contemporary Europe. Let me then begin now by addressing the issue of political membership in contemporary normative theory. Political membership, that is, the principles of incorporating aliens and strangers, immigrants and newcomers, refugees and asylum seekers into existing polities, has rarely been considered an important aspect of theories of domestic or international justice. The one exception here is Michael Walzer's Spheres of Justice, published in 1983. Walzer pointed out that membership was the first social good that needed to be distributed, in that the distribution of all other goods, like income and positions, benefits and opportunities, depended upon individuals as being recognized as members of a polity who would then subsequently be entitled to these goods and benefits. Yet 10 years later, in his Political Liberalism, John Rawls would still assume, I'm quoting, that a democratic society, like any political society, is to be viewed as a complete and closed social system. It is complete in that it is self-sufficient and has a place for all the main purposes of human life. It is also closed in that entry into it is only by birth and exit from it only by death. Thus, continuing to quote Rawls, we are not seen as joining society at the age of reason as we might join an association, but as being born into a society where we will lead a complete life, end of quote. Surely, Rawls meant to use the model of a closed society as a counterfactual fiction, as a convenient thought experiment in reasoning about justice. Yet by not making conditions of entry and exit into the political community a central aspect of a liberal democratic theory of justice, he assumed that the state-centric model of nations with fairly closed and well-guarded borders would continue to govern our thinking in these matters. This was made amply clear in his subsequent Law of Peoples, and I'm quoting again, an important role of a people's government, however arbitrary a society's boundaries may appear from a historical point of view, is to be the representative and effective agent of a people as they take responsibility for their territory and its environmental integrity, as well as for the size of its population. Rawls adds in a note that this remark implies that a people has at least a qualified right to limit immigration. I leave aside what these qualifications might be, end of quote. Immigration issues then, or more broadly, entry and exit into liberal democratic polities are not central to the law of peoples. Rawls assumes that once a reasonable conception of the law of peoples has been established and accepted by the nations of the world, there will be no reason for transnational migrations. The reasons which cause migrations, like persecution by one's own government, political injustice at home, the unequal and discriminatory treatment of women, will have been eliminated in this ideal world. Rawls is curiously silent about immigration resulting from economic disparities among nations, suggesting at several points that the poor nations of the world are morally responsible for their economic plight. Migrations, then, remain an aspect of non-ideal theory, in Rawlsian terms, and are to be considered normatively as well as institutionally insignificant aspects of the law of peoples. By contrast, I would like to argue that transnational migrations and the constitutional as well as policy issues suggested by the movement of peoples across borders are central to interstate relations. It is not so much Rawls's claim that there must be boundaries of some kind, which is problematical, but rather the disregard of the rights and claims of others as they relate to and affect the identity of liberal democratic polities that is questionable. In not articulating explicit conditions of entry and exit in liberal democracies, Rawls is misconstruing the nature of membership in such associations. From a philosophical point of view, these issues bring to the fore the constitutive dilemma between sovereign self-determination claims on the one hand and human rights principles on the other. I will claim that the normative issues raised by practices of political membership can best be analyzed through an internal reconstruction of the dual commitments of liberal democracies to human rights on the one hand and collective self-determination on the other. My argumentation strategy differs in this regard from several contemporary approaches to these issues, which I shall briefly name moral cosmopolitanism, deterritorialized and post-national citizenship, and the decline of citizenship approaches. And let me very briefly say something about each of these approaches. I know that for the purposes of time, I won't be able to do justice to all the differentiations, but just to set off my claims from other arguments at the moment. Advocates of open borders and cosmopolitical citizenship, like Joseph Cairns and Martha Nussbaum, align themselves with the Kantian legacy of a world republic in order to articulate the transformative potentials of the present. From a moral point of view, national borders are arbitrary, and the only morally consistent universalist position would be one of open borders. Joseph Cairns, for example, uses the device of the Rawlsian veil of ignorance and against the intentions of Rawls himself, as we have seen, to think through the principles of justice from the standpoint of the refugee, the immigrant, and the asylum seeker. Citizenship status and privileges, which are simply based upon territorially defined birthright, argues Cairns, are no less arbitrary than one's skin color and other genetic endowments. Therefore, liberal democracies should practice policies which are as compatible as possible with the vision of a world without borders. Cosmopolitical citizenship, as advocated by Martha Nussbaum, entails not so much a moral political practice, but a moral attitude of not placing the affairs and concerns of one's immediate community ahead of those of others who may be strangers to us residing in faraway worlds. In Nussbaum's version, cosmopolitanism is a universalist ethic that denies the claims upon us of what is known in moral theory as special obligations. These are obligations which emerge out of our situatedness in concrete human communities of descent or sympathy, genealogy or affiliation. Nussbaum denies that patriotism, or a privileged commitment to a specific territorially bounded community, constitutes a special moral obligation. Patriotism does not trump the love of humanity. Even if we concede that such a cosmopolitical moral attitude may have many arguments to recommend it in many circumstances, it is wholly unclear what political, as opposed to moral practices, cosmopolitical citizenship would assume, and which institutions, if any, would correspond to this mindset. It is interesting to note also that this was not the meaning of cosmopolitanism for Kant himself, who saw world government to be a form of despotism. More significantly, these approaches avoid or skirt the paradox of democratic legitimacy, and in doing so, they fail to eliminate the internal contradictions of liberal democracies and of an international order based upon state sovereignty, and more on this below. Now, James Rosenau and Yasemin Soysal see the rise and spread of a new human rights regime, despite all its pitfalls and hypocrisies worldwide, as heralding a new political consciousness and new forms of political membership. The nation state is waning, they claim. The line between human rights and citizens' rights is being corroded. New modalities or deterritorialized citizenship are emerging. Especially within the European Union, argues Soysal, national identities and allegiances are being scrambled rapidly, and it would be hypocritical to want to make good Germans out of Turks when contemporary Germans themselves are hardly sure of what their own collective identity consists. Multicultural enclaves in large cities everywhere in the world are harbingers of the new faces of a citizenship which is no longer based upon exclusive attachments to a particular land, history, and tradition. I agree with advocates of deterritorialized citizenship that political identities need not be conceived in state-centric terms. The boundaries of the civic community and the boundaries of the national territory are not coterminous. Nonetheless, democratic commitment to a locality which may be smaller or larger than the nation state is significant, and democratic governance, as I will argue below, implies drawing boundaries and creating rules of membership. The boundaries of communities of self-governance need not coincide with those of the nation state, but the normative challenges of articulating boundaries will not disappear altogether. Now, the third position I'd like to briefly consider is the decline of citizenship school. This includes civic republicans as well as communitarians. Michael Walzer, Michael Sandel, and David Jacobson. They all argued that the waning of the nation state, whether under the impact of the rise of international human rights norms or through the spread of attitudes of cosmopolitical detachment, result in the devaluation of citizenship as an institution and practice. Citizenship, they claim, entails membership in a bounded community. The right to the determination of the boundaries as well as identity of this community are fundamental to democracy. Therefore, the argument goes, economic and political globalization threaten to undermine the institution of citizenship. While immigration is not precluded by these authors, they tend to favor the incorporation only of those foreigners who are like us and who become the model citizen. These attempts to suggest new modalities of political membership in a globalized world have been invariably vague. The institutional and normative practices that would need to accompany deterritorialized and cosmopolitan citizenship have not been articulated. More significantly, all three approaches avoid or skirt a paradox, the paradox of democratic legitimacy. Advocates of deterritorialized and cosmopolitan citizenship hardly face that there is a paradox. Defenders of civic republicanism refuse to acknowledge that there is a paradox at all, in that they simply subordinate universal rights to self-determination claims. Let me explain now what I see to be the paradox of democratic legitimacy. Ideally, democratic rule means that all members of a sovereign body are to be respected as bearers of human rights, and that the consociates of the sovereign freely associate with one another to establish a regime of self-governance under which each is to be considered both the author of the laws and subject to them. This ideal of the social contract, as formulated by Jean-Jacques Rousseau, is a heuristically useful device for capturing the logic of modern democracies. Modern democracies, unlike their ancient counterparts, conceive of their citizens as right-bearing consociates. The rights of the citizen rest upon the rights of man. Les droits de l'homme et de citoyen do not contradict one another, quite to the contrary, they are implicated. This is the idealized logic of the modern democratic revolutions following the American and the French models. The democratic sovereign draws its legitimacy not merely from its act of constitution, but equally significantly from the conformity of this act to universal principles of rights, which are in some sense set to precede and antedate the will of the sovereign, and in accordance with which the sovereign undertakes to bind itself. We, the people, refers to a particular human community circumscribed in space and time, sharing a particular culture, history, and legacy. Yet this people establishes itself as a democratic body by acting in the name of the universal. The tension between universal rights claims and particularistic cultural and national identities is constitutive of democratic legitimacy. Modern democracies act in the name of the universal, which are then circumscribed within a particular civic community. Since Rousseau, however, we know that the will of the democratic people may be legitimate but unjust, unanimous but unwise. The general will and the will of all may not overlap either in theory or in practice. Democratic rule and the claims of justice may contradict one another. The democratic pre-commitments expressed in the idealized allegiance to universal human rights like life, liberty, some form of property, need to be re-actualized and renegotiated within actual politics as democratic intentions. Potentially, there is always a conflict between an interpretation of these right claims which precede the declared formulations of the ideal sovereign and the actual enactments of the democratic people which could potentially violate these interpretations. We encounter this conflict in the history of political thought as the conflict between liberalism and democracy, and even as the conflict between constitutionalism and popular sovereignty. In each case, the logic of the conflict is the same. To assure that the democratic sovereign will uphold certain constraints upon its will in virtue of its pre-commitment to certain formal and substantive interpretation of rights. Liberal and democratic theorists disagree with one another as to the proper balance of this mix. While strong liberals want to bind the sovereign will through pre-commitments to a list of human rights, strong Democrats reject such a pre-political understanding of rights and argue that these must be open to renegotiation and reinterpretation by the sovereign people, admittedly within certain limits. Yet this paradox of democratic legitimacy has a corollary which has been little noted. Every act of self-legislation is also an act of self-constitution. We the people, and John Donne reminded me that although this phrase is English, it is not a British phrase. We the people who agree to bind ourselves by these laws are also defining ourselves as a we in the very act of self-legislation. It is not only the general laws of self-government which are articulated in this process. The community which binds itself by these laws defines itself by drawing its boundaries as well. And these boundaries are territorial as well as civic. The will of the democratic sovereign can only extend over the territory which is under its jurisdiction. Democracies require borders. Empires have frontiers, while democracies have borders. Democratic rule, unlike imperial dominion, is exercised in the name of some specific constituency and binds that constituency alone. Therefore, at the same time that the sovereign defines itself territorially, it also defines itself in civic terms. Those who are full members of the sovereign body are distinguished from those who fall under its protection but who do not enjoy full membership rights. Women and slaves, servants and propertyless white males, non-Christians and non-white races were historically excluded from membership in the sovereign body and from the project of citizenship. They were, in Kant's famous words, mere auxiliaries to the Commonwealth. The boundaries of the civil community then are of two kinds. On the one hand, these boundaries define the status of those who enjoy second-class citizenship within the polity, but who can be considered members of the sovereign people in virtue of cultural, familial, and religious attachments. Women, as well as non-propertied males, before the extension of universal suffrage, fell under this category. The status of these groups is distinct, however, from that of other residents who not only have second-class status, but who also do not belong to the sovereign people in virtue of relevant identity-based criteria. Such was the status of African-American slaves until after the Civil War in the United States and the declaration in 1865 of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which conferred U.S. citizenship upon African-American peoples. Such was also the status of American Indians, who were then granted tribal sovereignty. The status of those of Jewish faith in the original 13 colonies of the U.S. can also be described as one of transition from being mere auxiliaries to the Commonwealth to becoming full-fledged citizens. In addition to these groups, are those residents of the Commonwealth who do not enjoy full citizenship rights either because they do not possess the requisite identity criteria through which the people defines itself, or because they belong to some other Commonwealth, or because they choose to remain outsiders. These are the aliens and foreigners amidst the democratic people. Their status is distinct from second-class citizens historically, like women and workers had been, as well as from slaves and tribal peoples. Their status is governed by mutual treaties among sovereign entities, as would be the case with official representatives of a state power upon the territory of another, or if they are civilians and live among the citizens for economic, religious, or other cultural reasons, their rights and claims exist in that murky space defined by respect for human rights on the one hand, by international customary law on the other. These are refugees from religious persecution, merchants and missionaries, migrants and adventurers, explorers and fortune seekers. I have so far circumscribed in general theoretical terms the paradox of democratic legitimacy. To repeat, the paradox is that a self-determining collectivity should undertake to bind its will by a series of pre-commitments to a set of formal and substantive norms, usually referred to as human rights. The rights and claims of others, be they auxiliaries to the Commonwealth, such as women, slaves, and propertyless males were considered to be, or be they subjugated peoples and foreigners, are then negotiated upon this terrain, flanked by human rights on the one hand and sovereignty assertions on the other. What I would now like to do in the second half of my lecture is apply, if you wish, these normative considerations to the institutional puzzles and dilemmas that are facing at the moment citizenship, and in particular, I will focus on certain developments which will certainly be familiar to many of you within the European Union. I would now like to develop a sociological model of citizenship and show how institutional developments within the EU in particular have led to a new reconfiguration of human rights and sovereignty claims. What is emerging at the present, I want to argue, is a disaggregation of citizenship and differential rights regimes for different groups. Increasingly, entitlement to rights is dependent upon residency status rather than political membership. Conflicting and divergent institutional trends are visible throughout Europe, and this raises all the more urgently the question of democratic membership and how it is to be understood. Citizenship in the modern world has meant membership in a bounded political community, which was either a nation state, a multinational state, or a federation. The political regime of territorially bounded sovereignty, exercised through formal, rational administrative procedures and dependent upon the democratic will formation of a more or less culturally homogeneous people, could only function by defining, circumscribing, and controlling citizenship. The citizen is the individual who has membership rights to reside within a territory, who is subject to the state's administrative jurisdiction, and who is also ideally a member of the democratic sovereign in the name of whom laws are issued and administration is exercised. Following Max Weber, we may say that this unity of residency, administrative subjection, democratic participation, and cultural membership has constituted the ideal typical model of citizenship in the modern nation state of the West. The influence of this model, whether or not it actually corresponds to local conditions, however, extends far beyond the West. Modernizing nations in Africa, the Middle East, and Asia, which entered the process of state formation at later points than their Western European counterparts, have copied this model wherever they came into existence as well. Again, I'm assuming this model consists of the unity of residency, administrative subjection, democratic participation, and cultural membership. What is the status of citizenship today in a world of increasingly deterritorialized politics? As a normative category as well as institutional practice, which has so far defined political membership in the state-centric world, how is citizenship being reconfigured under contemporary conditions? How has the fraying of the various functions of the state under conditions of globalization affected the theory and practice of citizenship? The practice and institution of citizenship can be disaggregated into three components: collective identity, privileges of political membership, and social rights and benefits. While political theorists have tended to focus primarily on the privileges of political membership, social scientists and social historians have been more interested in the formation of collective identities and the evolution of rights claims associated with the status of citizenship. The view that citizenship can be understood as a status that entitles one to a bundle of benefits as well as committing one to certain obligations derives from Marshall. In his classical essay, Citizenship and Social Class, Marshall listed civil, political, and social rights as being central to an understanding of citizenship. These rights, in Marshall's account, are attained through the struggles for expanding democracy in the 19th and early part of the 20th centuries. Civil rights arise with the birth of the absolutist state, and in their earliest and most basic form, they entail the rights to the protection of life, liberty, and property, the right to freedom of conscience, and certain associational rights like those of commercial contract and marriage. Political rights, in the narrow sense, refer to the rights of self-determination, to run for and hold office, to enjoy freedom of speech and opinion, the right to establish political and non-political associations, including a free press and the free institutions of science and culture. Social rights, as you will recall, are the last in Marshall's catalog because they have been achieved historically through the struggle of the workers, women's, and other social movements. Social rights entail the right to form trade unions as well as other professional and trade associations, healthcare rights, unemployment compensation, old age pensions, childcare, housing, and educational subsidies. These social rights, of course, vary widely across countries and depend on the social class compromises prevalent in any given welfare state democracy. Their inclusion in any internationally agreed upon catalog of universal rights beyond the mere right to employment and a decent standard of living, as you well know, is a bone of contention among different countries with different economic outlooks and regimes. Now, the primary focus of citizenship studies in political philosophy had been, until very recently, upon the privileges of membership. Largely under the influence of the liberal communitarian controversy, which dominated US political theory in the 1970s and 80s, the theory and practice of citizenship was examined from the standpoint of one predominant theme. In light of divergent conceptions of liberal justice and of the human good, how should we think of the virtues and obligations of the citizen? Should citizens view themselves as moral persons with multiple and competing allegiances, as liberals enjoin them to do? Or should citizenship be viewed as a thick moral identity that is constitutive of who we are as individuals in some deep sense as communitarians enjoin them to? This literature on the virtues and duties of citizenship was largely removed from the historical and social analysis of the transformations of and practices of citizenship. And in going back to T.H. Marshall's essay, I'm trying to retrieve, if you wish, some institutional realism for political theory and to bring together normative and institutional considerations. The irony of current citizenship and immigration practices in most liberal democracies in the world, including the United States, is that whereas social rights and benefits like unemployment compensation, retirement, some form of health insurance, and in some cases educational and housing subsidies, and there is great variation across countries in these rights, but whereas certain social rights and benefits are granted to citizens as well as legal aliens and residents, the transition to political rights and the privileges of membership remains blocked or is made, in most cases, extremely difficult. One can have one set of rights and claims without the other. One can have political rights without being a national, as in the case of the EU. More commonly, though, one has social rights and benefits in virtue of being a foreign worker or a resident without either sharing in the same collective identity or having the privileges of political membership. The danger in this situation is that of permanent alienage, namely the creation of a group in society that partakes of property rights and civil society without having access to political rights. I want to illustrate now this disaggregation effect with reference to the rights regimes in contemporary European Union, in which the rights of citizens of member countries of the EU are sharply delineated from that of third country nationals within a patchwork of local, national, and supranational rights regimes. Contemporary developments within the Union both reveal the disaggregation of the various dimensions of rights and the continuing problematic coupling of cultural identity with political citizenship. Again, I'd like to add here that my brief familiarity with conditions in the UK indicates to me that this country is an exception to almost every single generalization that one can make about immigration, citizenship, and residency. When I first started working on these issues, I was very focused on the German model, which I know quite well, and then widened it to Austria and to France. So please think a continental model when I am making this claim, because I know the situation in the UK is in interesting and subtle ways quite different. Let me try to spell out, though, how this disaggregation effect in citizenship claims is coming into being at the moment. The Treaty of Maastricht, as you well know, made provisions for a union citizenship. Nationals of all countries who are members of the EU are also citizens of the European community. What does being a citizen of the Union mean, though? What privileges and responsibilities, what rights and duties does this entitle one to? Is citizenship of the Union merely a status category, just as being a member of the Roman Empire was? Does membership in the Union amount to anything more than possessing a passport, which allows one to pass through the right doors at border crossings? Clearly, Union membership is intended to be more than that. It is not just a passive status, but is also intended to designate an active civic identity. Members of the Union can settle in any country in the Union, take up jobs in these countries, and vote, as well as stand for office in local elections and in elections for the Parliament of Europe. As European unification progresses, there is also a debate as to whether or not Union citizenship should entail an equivalent package of social rights and benefits like unemployment compensation, healthcare, and old age pensions, which members of the EU states can enjoy wherever they go. But the obverse side of membership in the Union is a sharper delineation of the condition of non-members. The agreements of Schengen and Dublin, intended to reconcile diverse practices of granting asylum and refugee status throughout member states. Referred to as legal harmonization, these agreements have made the granting of refugee and asylum status in the Union increasingly difficult. An individual who seeks refuge and asylum in a member country is not permitted to apply in another country of the Union until the first application is resolved. Although it is left unsaid, the presumption is that once such an application has been denied in one member country, it is unlikely to succeed in another. The decision of the European Council of Ministers to erect a union-wide office to deal with refugee and asylum issues while creating legal and bureaucratic homogenization and standardization intends to make Europe's borders less porous by disallowing individuals in need multiple venues of aid and rescue. As Union citizenship progresses, in each member country, discrepancies are also emerging between those who are foreigners and third country nationals and those who are foreign nationals but EU members. A two-tiered status of foreignness is thus evolving. On the one hand, there are third country national foreign residents of European countries, some of whom have been born and raised in these countries and who know of no other homeland. On the other hand are those who may be near to total strangers to the language, customs, and history of their host country, but who enjoy special status and privilege in virtue of being nationals of the of states which are EU members. Members of the 15 EU countries who are residents in countries different than those of their nationality, as I mentioned before, can vote, run for, and hold office in municipal elections and elections for European Parliament. Again, as a rule, and in the continent, this is not granted to third country nationals, though some EU countries like Denmark, Sweden, Finland, Holland, as well as Ireland, permit foreigners who have fulfilled certain residency requirements to vote in local and even in some cases regional elections. And this is certainly the case in the UK for Commonwealth citizens. I am less clear about the status of third country nationals who are not Commonwealth citizens. But by and large, the model is that with Denmark, Sweden, Finland, Holland, and Ireland do permit third country nationals who have fulfilled certain residency requirements, local and in some cases regional voting rights. Partially in response to the growing pressures created by the inequality in the situation of third country nationals, Germany on May 7, 1999 had reformed its 1913 citizenship law. The German parliament accepted by a two-thirds majority the principle that the principle of jus sanguinis be supplemented by jus soli in the acquisition of German citizenship. From January 1, 2000 on, children born to foreign parents who have resided in the country for 8 years acquire the German citizenship without the forfeiting the passes they hold. When they reach the age of 23, they must decide for one passport or another. And as you well know, the question of dual citizenship is still heavily contested in the continent, and it's not at the present permitted in Germany, and I suspect that the result of the elections this fall will make it even less likely that it will be. Since the Treaty of Amsterdam signed on May 1, 1997, there is also growing awareness as well as desire among EU member countries to harmonize the citizenship and naturalization laws of distinct member countries and to reduce discrepancies in the juridical and political status of EU citizens and third country nationals. According to the Treaty of Amsterdam, naturalization, immigration, refugee, and asylum policies within the EU still remain in the third pillar. The third pillar is defined as intergovernmental law and is subject to discretionary agreement and cooperation as well as the conventions of international public law. In these areas, a unanimous decision procedure will hold till the year 2004. In other words, although EU member countries retain sovereign discretion over their immigration and asylum policies, quote, the Treaty of Amsterdam, and I'm quoting from the language of the treaty, firmly embeds immigration and asylum policies within an EC framework. Since access to entry, however, is still determined by individual states, the civil and economic status of third country nationals is subject to considerable variation across EU states. Rights of mobility, domicile, and employment are not union-wide. In this respect, the extension of full civil rights to third country nationals remains incomplete. The resolutions of the European Council reached in Tampere again reiterated the commitment to European integration based on respect for human rights, democratic institutions, and the rule of law. The Council emphasized that these principles cannot be seen as the exclusive preserve of the Union's own citizens. I'm quoting, "It would be in contradiction with Europe's traditions to deny such freedoms to those whose circumstances led them justifiably to seek access to our territory. This in turn requires the Union to develop common policies on asylum and immigration while taking into account the need for a consistent control of external borders to stop illegal immigration and to combat those who organize it and commit international crimes," end of quote. I should also mention in this context that despite these pious wishes, refugees and asylees whose applications are in process have no right of free movement or employment within the EU. The employment issue is just now being debated. No rights to civil association beyond marriage, and no rights of appeal against any deportation injunction. They are in a limbo status in juridical terms, or in Hannah Arendt's famous language, their right to have rights is still contested. These developments within the EU point in contradictory directions. While throughout the European Union, a dissociation of cultural identity from the privileges of political citizenship can be observed for EU citizens, for third country resident nationals, the ties between identities and institutions, between national membership and democratic citizenship rights are reinforced. Yet a trend towards the liberalization of naturalization rights is visible EU-wide as well. With the exception of Austria, Luxembourg, and Greece, most EU countries permit citizenship by naturalization. And after the reform of Germany's jus sanguinis citizenship law, most EU countries practice a form of more or less liberalized jus soli, that is, territorial naturalization of children of first or second generation immigrants. The one exception to this trend towards political participation through nationalization, through assuming nation-state citizenship, is the city of Amsterdam. The Dutch model is quite unique in that the city of Amsterdam grants city citizenship to its foreign residents after 5 years of residence and permits them to take part in citywide elections and to form political parties. The government of Amsterdam has gone farthest in dissociating the expectation of a homogeneous cultural identity from the exercise of political citizenship rights. The granting of political rights to third country national residents of the city Amsterdam does not alter their status within the European Union, however. They are still unable to move freely to France from the Netherlands, let us say, and to assume residence and employment there. However, the fact that their interests and voices are represented at the municipal level means that they will be effective participants in the national dialogue concerning their juridical status. The existing discrepancy between the political participation rights of EU citizens and third country nationals across the EU and within each member country is one aspect of the two-tiered status of membership that is currently developing. Equally significant are the restrictions on the mobility and employment opportunities of third country nationals with legal residency status. Given the totally unclear status of European citizenship as distinct from national membership, an EU-wide residency status for third country nationals still appears inconceivable. It is evident, therefore, that European expansion in 2003 and 2007 if and when it comes to pass, will do little to alter the legal status of most third country nationals, since neither Turkey nor the former Yugoslav states, with the exception of Slovenia, nor Algeria, nor Morocco, nor Albania will become members of the European Union in the foreseeable future. To the contrary, given that the largest number of third country nationals within the EU are also from Muslim countries, after the events of September 11, 2001, there is less sympathy for these groups and less interest for bringing their juridical status in line with that of other residents. Let me start moving now towards my concluding considerations. The European Union, then, reproduces at the supranational level the internal tensions of modern nation states, while also showing tendencies towards their evolution along a different path. The modern nation state fused together identitarian and democratic understandings of the citizenry through processes of contestation, struggle, as well as cooperation and cooptation. To return again to Marshall's classical essay, Marshall focused on citizenship rights in the modern state in order to analyze how a capitalist state, which was still based on the wage labor contract, could nonetheless win the allegiance of the working classes by granting them a status, the status of citizenship. Marshall saw in these developments a reversal of Sir Henry Maine's well-known typology from status to contract. To the contrary, argued Marshall, the trend in the modern state is from contract to status, in that citizenship was a status whose value could not be affected by the wage labor contract. Citizenship remedied and rectified the indignities of capitalist inequality by giving the working classes access to the material conditions necessary for a quote-unquote civilized existence, a very important category in Marshall's essay. Yet these compensatory achievements of citizenship were dependent in crucial ways upon the presence of those who did not have access to citizenship and upon whom were heaped not only the indignities of wage labor, but not being full members of the Commonwealth as well. Marshall could not admit, as Kant so blithely could, that there were mere auxiliaries to the Commonwealth. It is poignant in retrospect to read the naivete with which Marshall neglects the relationship of republic and empire, the insiders and the outsiders. It is important to recall these insights and illusions of Marshall's renowned essay, because there is a widespread tendency in contemporary political thought to look upon the formation of collective identities and of cultural solidarities not as having been attained through long drawn out and bitter processes of conflict, but as if they were idealized and stable givens. It is the static vision of collective identity formation which makes it plausible for Michael Walzer and following him, for John Rawls, David Miller, Michael Sandel and others, the Decline of Citizenship group, to assume that aliens and others pose a threat to or dilute or overrun an already attained community of solidarity. But the collective identities of liberal democracies are never characterized by the degree of cohesiveness and cultural centeredness which these theorists attribute to them. Wanting to exclude the outsiders without, or closing one's doors to newcomers, is always accompanied by the need to discipline outsiders within and to prevent reform, innovation, dissent, and transformation within the walls of one's own parish. The politics of immigration is always closely linked to the politics of conformism and disciplining the opposition at home. The treatment of aliens, foreigners, and others in our midst is a crucial test case for the moral conscience as well as political reflexivity of liberal democracies. Defining the identity of the sovereign nation is itself a process of fluid, open, and contentious public debate. The lines separating we and you, us and them, more often than not, rest on unexamined prejudices, ancient battles, historical injustices, and sheer administrative fiat. The beginnings of every modern nation state carry the seeds of some violence and injustice. So far, Carl Schmitt is right. Nonetheless, modern liberal democracies are self-limiting collectivities which at one and the same time constitute a demos as sovereign while proclaiming that the sovereignty of this demos derives its legitimacy from its adherence to fundamental human rights principles. We the people is an inherently fraught formula containing in its very articulation the constitutive dilemmas of respect for human rights and nationally circumscribed sovereignty claims. The rights of foreigners and aliens, whether they be refugees or guest workers, asylum seekers or adventurers, define that threshold, that boundary, at the site of which the identity of we the people is defined and renegotiated, bounded and unraveled, circumscribed and rendered fluid. We are at a point in political evolution when the unitary model of citizenship, which bundled together residency upon a single territory, with the subjection to a single administration of a people perceived to be a more or less cohesive entity, is at an end. The end of this model means neither that its hold upon our political imagination nor its normative force in guiding our institutions is obsolete. It does mean, however, that we must be ready to imagine forms of political agency and subjectivity which anticipate new modalities of citizenship in a globalized world. Thank you.
Professor Ben Habib has kindly said that she will take questions for the next 20 minutes. Would you like to stay up there, or do you want to come and
no,
sit
down? No, I'm happy
you
to stay
there. Fine. All right.
Okay, in considering aliens, there's an interesting mirror issue which I wondered what you thought about as well. That's the case of non-resident citizens. After all, if one's going to, as at least some tendencies within the EU suggest, run residents and citizens' rights together, one might simply, as a normative ideal, take there to be citizenship in virtue of two different claims. Citizenship in virtue of nationality, and citizenship in virtue of residence, where citizenship rights in virtue of nationality, other than the right of entry, are not active if you're not resident. Okay, so you don't have a right to vote, etc., if you're not resident there. Now, since I'm not entirely clear of what the sort of normative position you're ending up with is, maybe if you could just comment on that as a normative ideal, I might get a bit clearer.
No. You're right. That's an absolutely interesting. Maybe you know from my argument, it became a kind of residual category in most sort of Republican sovereignty models. It appears that way. The status of non-resident citizenship. I should say that in the larger and longer argument which I'm trying to develop, I make an argument against denaturalization. And I claim that denaturalization, in fact, violates the human right to membership. And I try to build up that claim in part by following on this Arendtian insight of the right to have rights. And I argue that denationalization, which can befall non-resident citizens very easily in certain cases, is not to be used. Now, the question that emerges for me about non-resident citizenship status is whether, in effect, this category, which I think in numbers is still fairly small to the other categories that I considered, whether this category would end up one with the condition of alienage, political alienage that I referred to. You remain a citizen of one country, you are an expat, right? You live somewhere else all your life, and that's your good right. But should you have any participation rights, or should there be any participation channels even? And for me, that would be an important issue. It would be less the status of non-residency, and that certainly should not lead to denationalization. But more the question of whether non-resident citizenship status would end up undermining or would lead to the undermining of political participation claims. Because, you see, the issue that interests me in the status of third country nationals within the EU, and the reason why I am focusing on this is also as a normative theorist in terms of possibilities for democratic citizenship in the present. As long as the model of political participation is only nationalization, either assuming the nationality of the country in which you are resident, Germany, France, UK, Italy, Austria, or whatever, and that's the only way to go for third country nationals, there is, I think, a danger. And I believe this is true in many cases, that unless dual nationality, dual citizenship is introduced, people will choose to remain permanent others. That is, they will stay as guest workers, residents for 20, 25, 30 years, and they will never become voting democratic participants. They remain non-resident citizens vis-a-vis their own countries, and yet at the same time, they do not exercise citizenship rights in the countries in which they are, you know, resident. This is a concern to me, and I'll just add this, because it also seems to me it may be one of the unintended consequences, but a great danger of global capital and labor movements, that we end up creating also this mobile labor force, and labor is never as mobile as capital, but that we could end up creating this, you know, worldwide mobile labor force of individuals basically without democratic attachments. And that, for me, is not a good outcome. So it's a very interesting question. I sort of looked at it, you know, as you say, through the other mirror. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank
A follow-up. Would you say more about how you would analyze the question of dual citizenship?
Recently, I have come up with an analogy. I think that when we think about dual citizenship, there seems to be this model of exclusive loyalty and attachment. And I say, is it inconceivable to think of a life where you have fallen in love more than once? Why is it inconceivable to think of having more than one set of loyalties and attachments? And what is the sort of the moral argument of possessiveness that states make? I mean, there's an administrative regulatory claim of agencies and, you know, taxes and inheritance and you know, children's status and all that. But from a moral point of view, I do not quite understand this exclusive demand for loyalty, because I think that it is up to adult autonomous individuals, you know, to balance and to negotiate, you know, these multiple claims and allegiances. And in the hard cases where people have had to make those choices, they actually have. I mean, there are some very poignant stories of people of German extraction, you know, who were American citizens, who went to war in the Second World War, you know, against relatives. I think that administrative arguments are one issue, but I don't see the moral claim for exclusive citizenship.
Well, I am only the director of one immigrants organization here in UK, and I just wanted to draw your attention regarding the situation of a huge number of immigrants that really want to be member of this society, and unfortunately the multicultural model is at the moment trying to keep us in ethnic organizations. I mean, not all the immigrants want to be apart. Not all the immigrants want to be in their ethnic communities, but with our free choice, we want to be part of this society and even taking these costumes and different language and well, it's our election and we would like to be recognized in that sense. So I wanted to draw your attention regarding this because there's been a huge debate because the Home Office apparently is asking for more integration to immigrants. But this is not only from the Home Office. There is a huge number of immigrants that really think exactly the same, but maybe you don't have that information because unfortunately most of the organizations that are really supportive are those precisely that wants to promote the multicultural model of ethnic organizations.
Can you say a little bit more about this model of ethnic organizations? Is it effective in the area of language and schooling rights? Because
yes,
there is great variation throughout Europe. And again, I'm more informed about the German, the French, the Dutch models, and we can talk. And on the whole, you know, right now multiculturalism is considered to be not a negative value in these debates, but I'll be interested if you can say more about how you think this ethnic, it sounds like you're complaining about ethnic, what we would call enclavism, enclaves, you know, creating segregation. How does this work? Can you say more?
Well, unfortunately, I am not a sociologist, so I can only speak by my experience, so
yes,
please. The thing is that, especially in the level of local governments, that this is very important for organizations that try to start from the scratch. The development workers, and especially the funds, I mean the money, that is really important for the organization to start the activities, are really given to organizations that try to promote ethnicity in their communities. And when in our case, for example, and sorry, I'm talking about my organization because it's my personal experience, and also because at the moment we've got from the Home Office the confirmation that this is the only organization in UK with this this set of aims.
Do you mind telling me what the name of the organization?
UK New Citizen.
UK?
New Citizen.
New Citizen.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I was telling you that especially at the level of the local government, the support and the financial support is given to ethnic organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, when you need some funds to translate from English to other languages, you've got the grants and the funds. The problem is when you try to translate from other languages to English. So in that case, you don't have access to funds. So I think that regarding the multicultural model, because I think maybe it's not fair to say that the multicultural model itself is bad. I'm talking about the application, the implementation in at the moment, because in theory, the multiculturalism is really something that I understand that has given a lot of good things in this society. The problem is that at the moment, maybe it's necessary a new approach to the multicultural model, and to understand that, again, not all the immigrants feel safe in their ethnic communities, mm-hmm. but try to integrate more actively to the white society.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, recently, I've been attending a meeting the local government, and it was told, for example, that many immigrants feel a bit frightened going to the town hall. And that sort of assumptions, I think that they are really, really sad.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, of course, this debate has its own particular parameters and flavor in every country. And I can see though the issues that you are pointing out to, and in some other work in a forthcoming book this August called The Claims of Culture, Equality and Diversity in the Global Era, I actually have argued against what I take to be the strong multiculturalist position of some of my good friends and colleagues like Jim Tully and Biko Parekh. And this has consequences for the immigration debate, which I didn't talk about here, but you're asking me to elaborate a little bit on that, and I'll be happy to. You see, the difficulty with the multicultural model is very simple, that it is trying to introduce an administratively manageable identification of groups at a period when individuals or allegiances define themselves as being members of more than one groups, want to have the autonomy to do so. And there is a complete conflict, I think, between administrative and policy logic, which sometimes takes itself to be progressive, and individuals' own needs and desires for self-ascription. Now, I argue for a model of what I call self-ascribed cultural narratives in this larger work. And one of the examples that I discuss is probably also unknown to you, is the categorization that we have in the US census of the various groups of, let's say, Asian American, African American, white, you know, Native Islanders. I mean, just these nonsense categories, which really belong to some extent to a racist past, where all the census tried to do was to track the issue of white-black intermarriages. And they used to divide everything else in the 1920s and 30s, for example. One talked about stock. There was the Scottish stock, the Irish stock, the German stock. Now these categories got, you know, modified into these five forms. And the embarrassment about the U.S. Census, and it's very interesting to follow this discussion if you are interested in multiculturalism, was that these five categories now are completely loosened up in such a way that under, for example, Asian American now, there are at least 8 to 10 categories that you can check off, and you can also say other and write yourself in, okay? So we are in the midst of a big debate about the sense and significance of these categories, which are not unimportant for everything from districting, voter districting to government policy, but they're also quite out of whack with existing self-understandings of communities and individuals. So when I look at Europe, it's strange because in some ways, you know, in some way it seems as if Europe is discovering a kind of multiculturalism which we are just coming out of. And this is also part of the immigration debate. And yet, on the other hand, you know, European cultures, since they are more, you know, they have understood themselves as more monolithic national cultures, the introduction of multiculturalism is not always bad. I mean, and to be very brief, take the French case, right? There was a big debate in France about the collection of ethnic data in social scientific research. There was a big scandal about this 4 or 5 years ago around the work of a sociologist, Michel Trabala, who insisted on using on some ethnicity-related data about, let's say, employment, education, integration patterns, and this was with respect to Turkish and Moroccan French immigrants. You know, she was accused of racism. One does not do this. We are a, you know, a colorblind society. We have the Republican model of equality. Every immigrant child born on French soil is a French citizen. Why is this relevant? Well, it is, you know, yes, the normative argument is very nice and good. But on the other hand, there has to be access to some of these materials without rigidifying them, it's a real dilemma, I think, right now of all identity politics, and that's why I think identity politics is really over, that on the one hand, you want to be sensitive to discrimination in society that is occurring along perceived group identities, and yet at the same time, you do not want to freeze group identities into administrative and juridical categories, which end up leading to the kinds of absurdities that you're talking about, that you have translation grants for putting things, you know, into your own languages, but not from your own language, putting them into English. So it's a very tricky and contested area now for the future.
Time for two more quick questions.
Mine will be very short. You told us quite a bit about the local dimension, the national dimension, and the European dimension of citizenship and identity. What is lacking is, of course, the global dimension. You mentioned it so very shortly with globalization. So my question is, do you see it as a threat, or is there a hope in the future that at least some of the problems you mentioned will be rendered more easy or solved if the global dimension would develop? Thank you.
I see it as a maybe contradictory present with some promising moments, but also some snags along the way. And there is obviously a model at the back, or I have been thinking about the principles of cosmopolitical justice, not of a world state, but the kind of cosmopolitan law and normative considerations that Kant used to articulate, and I do discuss this extensively in the longer project. But there are issues here, because so far globalization has meant more, the globalization of capital, information, finance, and communication, as well as tourism industries. I mean, it's a well-known fact that people don't move as fast as financial markets or electronic messages. And we are still somewhat a territorial being, though not uni-territorial beings. We do like to move. So there is the problem that if, you know, globalization is simply a project driven by the needs of international capitalism, institutions and situations will emerge which will have and are having the consequence of undermining sovereignty without substituting modalities of democratic control in their place. So I agree very much with some of the claims of my colleague David Held, who is on the faculty here, that although the concept of global government hardly appears desirable to any of us, there are issues of global governance, and questions of global governance can be dealt with at the level of civil society, transnational organizations, NGOs, and these are part and parcel of this broad network. And it is very, very clear that this is going to be the level at which a great deal of work needs to be done at the present. And I would say that perhaps a lot of work also around refugees and asylum rights requires transnational coordination. It requires not only harmonization at the legal level, but much more active cooperation among not just governments, because in many cases governments themselves are the problem that generate refugees. I mean, I haven't talked about internal migrations, people who move around in countries where there are civil wars or there's ethnic discrimination. You know, not all forms of discrimination amount to genocide. So according to some account, there are 30 million internally displaced peoples in 1999. These do not have the status of refugees because they do not cross boundaries, but they do move around within their own country because of existing conditions. So we have to think also beyond and below the governmental level, because very often governments themselves are complicitous in creating these conditions and not neutral actors. So I think that yes to thinking new modalities of global governance.
Last question.
Yes, you point to the democratic paradox of how a people can bind itself, but I wonder if the formula "we the people" raises a slightly deeper problem about the constitution of the people in the first place. What are the boundaries of the people? Mm-hmm. Your analysis points to the way in which non-democratic, not strictly territorial accounts of who the demos are operate to exclude people. So we can have the phenomenon of citizens and resident aliens with limited access to the same membership that nationals have. And it seems to me that the problem there is that what fills the gap, what gives us an account of who the people are, tend to be historical exclusive categories like the nation, of course. But I wonder, isn't there going to be a serious problem in trying to decouple these sort of exclusive accounts of membership from political membership, from membership of the demos? And this problem is the fact that you can't democratically decide who the people are, because any account of who the people are presupposes who those people are.
Right. This is a paradox which has been discussed. I don't know if you were thinking here also of Thomas Poggi's work or others, but this paradox of democratic constitution. My answer to this is that we have to focus on reflexivity. That is to say, just as, now speaking very much from the American perspective, okay, just as one does not treat the Constitution as an originary document to whose originary meaning one resorts, some do, but I don't accept this as a very legitimate philosophical access to the interpretation of text, but looks at a Constitution as a text, a body whose a body of principles whose meaning can be resignified and rearticulated. Some would say, the Derridians would say, iterated under certain circumstances, under certain conditions, a new reappropriation. I think the same is true about collective identity and the definition of the demos. Yes, there is a paradox of democratic legitimacy, because those who are entitled to decide who the citizens are, per definitionem, do not involve those who will not be citizens, right? Look at it this way, we just have to acknowledge this. Yet at the same time, if you take this political paradox, and I'm glad you brought me back to the first part of the lecture, which is the sort of the more the philosophical issue, that if you look at this paradox as simply being conclusive, and as all, you're not going to really move very far along. First, of course, the constitution of the demos itself is a process that is subject to argumentation and discussion, right? The we is itself contentious and fractured. Yeah? And even though from a formal point of view, there is always this distinction between the outsiders and the insiders, there will always be those consociates of the sovereign who will also claim and militate and work for the rights of the outsider. So the process is much messier than we think of, you know, from an institutional and historical point of view. And also, I think that there is a distinction here for me between the discursive moral ethic at the level of which all those who are affected by actions and norms must be participants in their legitimation, and the democratic principle, okay? The discursive principle and the democratic principle are not the same, precisely for the grounds that you point out, because the membership of the demos is always historically contingent. And yet, I think what one should argue here is that although if we tried to make the demos as inclusive of the community of mankind, we would simply collapse the political and the moral, the specificity of the political would be lost. We would no longer have individual republics. Okay? But if you think along the Kantian model of individual republics that try to mediate their political membership through these universal principles, right, that is, hold on to the tension between the moral and the political. Hold on to the tension between the universalist claims of inclusion and yet, you know, the practice of democratic exclusion and negotiate their friction. It is very important for me to be able to hold on to both sides of this dilemma and to think through within that space. And indeed, reflexivity, becoming, you know, more reflexive, is one issue. You know, this is one aspect. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed.